Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm going to have to get used to the delay between the time when I'm told the show starts and the Blog Talk Radio announces. Hello all, and welcome to episode 3 of Love Yourself, Love Your Life. I am your host, Christine Burke, of course, and as always, I am deeply honored to be with you tonight. We're on our third of the series of What If questions, and they're kind of exciting for me to go through the whole series of them because all of the questions have been designed to ask us whether or not we really understand the way life operates. And if we don't understand the way life operates, doesn't that mean that it's a little bit like we're traveling along without the user's manual that we always joke about needing? You know, well, yes, I've made mistakes in life, and I wouldn't have made them if only I had a user's manual. Well, the interesting thing is that there have been user's manuals of various sorts around for tens of thousands of years. All kinds of, well, I don't want to call them, all kinds of insights, all kinds of philosophies and practices around the world in which people understood the way the mind works, basically, the way the three levels or the three known levels of our minds work, the unconscious, which is kind of the part of us that manages our dreams and our physiology, keeps the hearts beating and, you know, the cells rejuvenating and whatnot. The consciousness, which is our waking aspect, the part of us that's aware of our five physical senses, and is sort of the part of us that we usually consider ourselves actually to be. We consider that aspect that we're aware of, that waking aspect, to be who we really are. And then the third aspect is the superconscious or the higher self, or depending on your belief system, you might refer to it as the soul, or it's commonly referred to by people as the heart self. And so, you know, people, we're all kind of aware of the fact that we have this kind of thinking, rational aspect that is logical and reasoning and very good at following rules, collecting and following rules. And then we also have this other aspect that wants what it wants for reasons that we don't understand. And sometimes that part of us has gotten a bad rep in the past, but that's really not its fault, because the soul is really not, or the soul or the higher self or the heart self is not a bad character. It just, because it doesn't fear life, because it doesn't think of itself as being only that wee bit of the mind that is the waking self, it doesn't have the same sorts of fears that we do. It also doesn't have the same objectives and agendas and whatnot, because it just experiences a much larger sense of self. Anyway, tonight's question, tonight's what if question is, what if our struggles are vital messages? What if all of our life struggles are really vital messages, absolutely vital messages that we need in order to lead happy, fulfilling, productive lives? In fact, what if you could go so far as to say that these are messages that we need, that we need to understand in order to even grasp or begin to grasp the purpose of life itself? And if, what if, in looking for the message in our struggles, not only will we achieve greater understanding of an aspect of our lives and an aspect of who we are and how our minds operate and how life operates, but what if the struggle itself will also disappear as a result of our inquiry? It's a really I don't know. I've been thinking about this, pondering this, writing about this, collecting evidence and teaching people about this for a lot of years now. So I say that kind of quickly without really concentrating on each of the words. And when I'm done, I think, gee, I wonder if somebody were tuning in and hearing that for the first time, if they'd have any idea what I had just said. So let's break that down a little bit. Is there anybody in the audience tonight who has, maybe is fortuitous enough that somebody might have a headache or a sore back or some sort of chronic pain? Generally speaking, there are four areas in our life where we struggle, four categories that the conscious mind concerns itself with. It's not, we actually, the struggles that we concern ourselves with are only on the conscious level. So the categories are our physical bodies, our relationships with anybody at any level. Number three is our career or our purpose, how we express ourselves in the world. And number four is money. And it's not just money, but it's, you know, the things that we acquire, the experiences that we have, the services that we pay for, all of that sort of thing. So I'm hoping, it's not awful, I'm hoping that somebody will share a physical ill. Please, doesn't anybody have a pain out there? Now I'm wondering if people are able to call in, because sometimes people are not. Yeah. Well, it says that if you need the call-in number, the guest call-in number, the number is 646-668-2970. If you're trying to call in and you can't, then I don't know what to tell you. We may just be doing another show where I'm talking to myself, which is, you know, unfortunate on the one hand, because I really want this program to be about working with people to have those personal breakthroughs that are so powerful. You know, somebody can tell you something and it can sound really nice or not, and it's still just something you've heard. But if you actually have the personal experience of applying something, a technique in your life, and finding out that it actually works, not just once, but over and over and over again, eventually it becomes this certainty that there are cause and effect relationships at work. And if we can understand and master those relationships, it not only can, but does completely transform our lives. The really exciting thing to me about this whole philosophy, I guess, I don't hate to call it philosophy, because one of the challenges in life today is that everything goes into a category, right? We've got so many categories. It's like, well, if you're writing a book, well, what category, what genre is your book? You know, does it go in history? Does it go in self-help? Does it go in politics? Does it go in religion? Does it go in spirituality, lifestyle, you know, health? Like, what relationship advice, like what category, what genre is your book? And the answer is, if you write, and the frustration is, if you write a book that's about navigating life, how can you exclude any aspect of life? All aspects of life operate exactly the same way. And the reason that we don't understand that, I mean, some of us do, obviously, because we've struggled and we've gone on these journeys for answers. But one of the reasons that so many of us weren't taught or didn't grow up knowing that life operates in accordance with absolutely flawless and predictable cause and effect relationships is because when you categorize everything, you effectively separate everything. And if everybody is separated, if all experiences are separated, you know, the physicist is separated from the chemist, is separated from the environmentalist, is separated from the doctor, is separated from the lawyer, and whatnot, and these guys aren't all interacting, then we're not able to see the big picture. It's like everybody's looking down their little lens into their tiny, specialized view of the world. And sure, people will understand some of the cause and effect relationships within that particular arena. You know, you might notice, for example, a lawyer might notice that people who are emotionally abused have a higher likelihood of committing crime, right? And somebody in the school system might recognize that emotionally disturbed children are more likely to act out in class. And a doctor might realize that emotionally abused children are more likely to suffer from allergies and physical abuse, right? And so everybody starts noticing, oh, yeah, there's this cause and effect relationship that is at work. When children or when people are emotionally abused, then we see it play out in this one way. But what if we were to go up to a level, up to a level where we could see that there are people who are, let's see, there are people who trust in life. There are people who are taught to trust in life and taught to understand life's language, or at least to be curious enough to try to follow and understand life's language. And then there are people who are afraid, people who learn to be afraid of this world. Children who are emotionally abused happen to be in a category, emotionally and or physically abused, happen to be in a category of people who have particularly, easily triggered fears. Maybe that's a good way. They're particularly fearful. And for good reason. And those, you know, children who were particularly fearful as children, as adults, are adults who are particularly fearful. And so when they're walking around out there in the world and they're, you know, committing crimes and doing other, you know, being, what's everybody call them now? I can think of as leeches on society, but that's, I actually see that on Facebook, where people who are dependent upon the welfare system or needing food stamps or whatever in order to help them to survive, people who don't use those services or don't need those services point fingers and say, you know, oh my God, you're dragging this country down because you need something I don't need. And the reality is that any of us would, had we grown up in the same circumstances as these people with the same level of fear. The level of fear that we grow up with and our sense of ourselves and whether or not we're up to facing and overcoming that scary world out there determines what outcomes and experiences we create in terms of our physical bodies, our health, our relationships, our careers, and our financial results. And it doesn't matter whether we're looking at it from, you know, the police officers or the teachers or Joe Public's perspective, it's always the same. I was thinking about, the whole idea of one religion has good guys and one religion has the bad guys. And, you know, one nation has the good people and one nation has the bad people. And all of this idea about good guys and bad guys and how one group is different from another group is what has fueled our fear and our traumas over millennia. So today I actually saw something on Facebook. I had no intention of going down this little rabbit hole, so that's interesting. But I saw something on Facebook about how there were a number of stores who were going to be open on Thanksgiving Day. And so now their employees need to work on Thanksgiving Day. And some people were suggesting, you know, that these stores were bad because their employees were being forced to work and it's Thanksgiving and, you know, we should honor Thanksgiving, we should honor the employees, and the employees should be home with their families having Thanksgiving. And then there were also some comments about how we should all be home on Thanksgiving with our families and nobody should be out shopping and, you know, what is wrong. So they were suggesting that we boycott these bad stores. So I read that and I thought, you know, here we go. It's always the same story. And Facebook, it's everywhere on Facebook. But the story is always good guys and bad guys, good guys and bad guys. And if you're on the side that's calling the other people the bad guys, then you feel good about yourself just because, oh, look, I'm not them. That must make me good. So I spent a lot of time working with business clients, business owners. And so when I see, you know, people saying that the stores, the employers, are the bad guys because they're forcing their employees to work on Thanksgiving Day, I think, you know, first of all, nobody's forced to work at all. I mean, it's either we choose to work or we choose not to work. And if we choose to work, and boy, this will create all kinds of craziness out there, but, you know, if we choose to work, let's at least honor ourselves enough to acknowledge that we're choosing to work, right? I choose to work. Why? Because I want to earn money, because I want to take care of myself and my family, because I want to make a contribution to the world, because, you know, my mom says I have to, right? If you're a teenager, maybe that's the case. I mean, there might be a lot of reasons why we choose to work. But when we say that we have to, when we just give up our power and we just say, no, I have to work and I have to work at any old job and I have no choice in it whatsoever, that's painting ourselves into this victim mentality, which just keeps people stuck in such miserable lives so needlessly. You know, the idea that you don't have a choice. I mean, if you do choose to earn a living to support yourself, wonderful. I mean, absolutely wonderful. But once you acknowledge, if you say, I'm giving myself, you know, I'm choosing to earn a living so that I can support myself, well, now that you're taking responsibility for having made that choice, what might a next reasonable step be? Might be to work in a place that's aligned with the way you look at life and the way you want to interact with life. So in other words, it's really important to me that I have family time, that I'm free when my family is free. And, you know, if that's on the weekends and the evenings and whatnot, then getting a job in a retail store, which depends upon being open when family members are all home, you know, when people are not working their 9-to-5 jobs, that's when retail businesses do most of their business. So if I'm going to get a job in a retail establishment, then there's a really good chance that I'm going to end up working when my family is home. So then it comes down to, well, if I'm going to be working when my family is home, let's say I decide, but I want to work in retail. Or let's even say, there's no other place in the world for me to work. There's one job in the entire world that's available, and it happens to be in a retail establishment. And so I chose to take that job. Okay, great. That probably makes a lot of sense, right? You chose to take that job, so that's great. Feel good about making that decision. Then when people say to you, or, you know, oh, you've got to work on Thanksgiving Day, it's like, well, what's more important? Is it more important to have a job, and maybe the only job in the entire world available to you, but is it more important to you that you chose to have a job and that you show up for your job as agreed in exchange for what you receive per agreement from that company? Or is it more important that your employer, wow, just completely lost my train of thought. That's interesting. Yes. So you want to live, what was that? Yeah, I don't know. So you want to live in alignment with or operate in a place where you're in alignment with the company that you're working for, or the people that you're, you know, that you're spending your time with, whatever the case may be. But this idea that the employer is responsible and the employer is victimizing employees was upsetting to me, and I don't think I've made my point yet because I talked in circles. Thank you for bearing with me. But my point actually is that as soon as we say that the employer is the bad guy, then we're suggesting that they're the enemy, that they're that they have power over the powerless employee who is a victim in the situation. And that sort of mentality perpetuates just pain and torture for people because people buy into it. You know, kids get out of high school or even drop out of high school, and they think the only opportunities for them are to get these minimum wage jobs. I mean, I heard about all of this during the minimum wage debates, and everybody was saying, you've got to raise the minimum wage, you've got to raise the minimum wage. And it's like, really? No, how about we have to teach people that they have other options besides working for minimum wage? They do. I don't care how much or how little education you have. You could walk dogs and make more money than people make on minimum wage, but you have to know that that's a possibility, and you have to know how to go about putting such an enterprise into practice. I see people doing it all the time, actually. I know people who make, you know, six figures a year walking dogs, and they actually, you know, enjoy it and build up whole companies from it. Not to say that, you know, everybody in the world can start a dog walking business. But it's upsetting to me when we all buy into the sort of, oh, the poor employee, because it's, if we tell the poor employee that they're a poor employee, then they're going to act like one. And it kind of brings us back around to the emotional abuse thing, because when you start telling people that they're victims, it's emotional abuse. It's lying. Nobody's a victim. Yeah, so this is going to get me a lot of slack. We're only victims if we participate in it. It's just, you know, it's ancient wisdom. It's the sages have been saying it throughout the ages. When Socrates said, "Know thyself," when Einstein said, "The most important decision we make is whether we believe we live in a friendly or hostile universe," when Shakespeare or whoever wrote tragedies and comedies about the human condition. You know, when Buddha said, oh, enter the void of space, get away from the drama. Like, everybody was talking about the same thing. And Jesus talked about it too. I can't remember exactly what words he was using, but this whole victim mentality is just poison in our society. And the other side of it is, you know, the employer side, working with business clients all the time and business owners, from the employee's perspective, it's always, oh, the business, you know, owner isn't giving me enough, like they're taking advantage of me. They ask me to do a job, which is ridiculous. I have to show up here 5 days a week or whatever it is. And, you know, the employee always says they don't get paid enough money and they've always got complaints. Not all employees, obviously, but most of the times when the employees come onto my radar screen, it's because there's some sort of problem. And normally it's mutual. Actually, not normally, always. I don't ever see a situation where the employer thinks that they have an award-winning employee and the employee thinks that the employer's awful, or the other way around. I mean, generally it's, you can tell what the relationship is by talking to either side, if people want to know. But on the employer side of the relationship, you know, even the business owners have a job to do. And their livelihood is depending upon them doing their job well. And one of the things that they're responsible for doing is making sure that they run a profitable business. Why? Because if they don't run a profitable business, then all of the people that they employ and the shareholders, if there are any, not to mention their own personal families, will be really disappointed and impacted because people could literally lose their jobs. A lot of years ago, I owned a small consulting business in Boston and the Back Bay. You know, we did a couple of $1 million a year. It was not a huge operation, but I had 10 employees at one point. And this feeling of responsibility, you know, feeling responsible, we had business clients. So I felt responsible for my business clients and making sure that they got what they needed from us, right, so that their business could be successful. I felt responsible for my employees because I was, you know, the source of their paychecks. And they had families and rents and mortgages and whatnot, commitments, obligations, and they depended upon me to get that, have money in order to pay all of their obligations. And then I had my own family, my own kids and my own house and my own, you know, all of that stuff. And so I have a real understanding and appreciation, perhaps more than most people might, but for what it feels like to be a business owner who really cares about the fact that a lot of people are relying upon you to not screw up. I suppose, you know, the CEO of Coca-Cola, you know, has a slightly different issue than the smaller business owners I'm thinking about in terms of, you know, cash flow and whatnot. I'm sure Coke doesn't really have cash problems. But, you know, the reality is most businesses in this country do. And a lot of retailers do because the bulk of their business is done between Thanksgiving and beginning of January when people take all of their, you know, all their gifts that don't fit or don't work or whatever back to the stores or exchange them and use their gift cards and whatnot. So most of their business actually occurs between, you know, during the holiday season. So, yeah, I understand, like, oh, isn't it nice if everybody gets to stay home on Thanksgiving, and, you know, personally, I haven't been to a store, well, not willingly, at least, in years. I thought the invention of online shopping was the best thing, way better than sliced bread. I don't know how far back you have to go before you can get something better than that, because I'm not into the shopping experience. But, you know, a lot of people are, and so if we need people in this time when a lot of us are abandoning the shopping experience and we're heading online to do our shopping, then the stores are getting pretty desperate for foot traffic, for customers. They need to extend that holiday shopping season as long as they can. They're responsible to their shareholders. They're responsible to their employees. They're responsible to their vendors, right? Because their vendors send them bills, and I forgot about that when I was talking about constituents earlier. Your vendors, they all need you to pay your bills, and you can't pay your bills unless you hit your sales targets, right? So before we, start throwing people under the bus, let's just take a moment to understand. Everybody is afraid of their own stuff. Everybody has their fears. Why do business owners open their stores on Thursday, on Thanksgiving afternoon? For the same reason, it's for the same reason that a child acts out in a classroom, or the same reason that somebody commits a crime on the street. It's because of fear. It's because everybody's scared. They might be afraid of slightly different things, right? One might be afraid of their self-image, and another might be afraid of being powerless because they've been taught that they're victims and they are powerless. So if we think that we have power, then it's kind of interesting to, we can try to maintain that power, that pride, by living up to what we think everybody's expectations are of us. If, on the other hand, we think we have no shot at ever attaining pride, which is the victim mentality, then we're going to act out in anger, because it sucks to live in this world without any sense of pride. To be ashamed in this world, imagine. And maybe some of you can. Actually, I mean, I think if we're all honest, all of us have felt these moments where we sat and we looked at, I don't know, people on television or in the movies or the bigwigs of today, the big celebrities of today, with all the glamour and the airbrushing and, you know, the edited bits of dialogue and whatnot, and pictures, and we look at them and say, wow, you know, look at them. Like, they're really out there living life and doing it large. And, you know, so look at me. Life's kind of passing me by, right? People are always talking to me about feeling stuck. And it's because we compare ourselves to these ridiculous ideals, which are fictionalized. And then we tell ourselves, well, I feel ashamed of that. Well, imagine, you know, the child that grows up in a bad situation, you know, in poverty, in emotionally abusive circumstances, or in a, like, physically dangerous neighborhood. And imagine a kid like that watching television and watching something like, you know, the Partridge Family or the Brady Bunch or, I don't know, what the modern equivalents are, because I don't watch TV anymore. The Waltons and Leave It to Beaver and watching all those kinds of shows and thinking that was the way other people really lived. And comparing themselves to that and saying, oh, my God, you know, how come I'm not like that? What's wrong with me? How come I got left out of the mix? And that fear would fester. There's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with me. Nobody can go around feeling like there's something wrong with me indefinitely before it comes out as aggressive behavior. And the aggression might be aimed outwardly or inwardly. Outwardly, we know what that looks like, right? It's anger, it's aggression, it's hostility, it's criminal acts, it's abuse, it's all that kind of stuff. Inwardly, it's drugs, it's alcohol, it's, you know, failure to thrive, failure to engage, failure to show up for work. You know what else it is? It's having a job and then failure to appreciate that job, because you tell yourself the same thing that society has always said, which is that we're victims of our employment status, that we're victims of the world and there's nothing we can do about it. What a load of bull. I'm so glad to tell you it's such a load of bull. It just makes my day. It does. Let's see. Well, I was kind of hoping. Yeah, you know what I'll do? I've been working with a lot of people recently who've been feeling stuck. And they're talking about, you know, being stuck in a body that's overweight. And everybody has their own idea of what overweight is, so I don't even know where to start with that one, really. But, if I want to, the first thing I tell people when they tell me that they feel stuck in a fat body is I say, great, throw away your scale. Numero uno, throw away your scale. And the look, oh, my God, I can't throw away my scale. If I throw away my scale, I won't know how fat I am. Like, yes, you mean you won't be able to torture yourself. Yeah, exactly. You won't know exactly how fat you are. But you know what, folks? We all have a general idea. Like, we do know. We know when we're feeling physically fit and healthy, and we know when we're not. We know when our clothes fit. We know when they don't. We really don't need that little grumpy scale sergeant, if you will, to say, okay, a 10 hut, you know, approach, stand up there, and let me give you your verdict for the day about how good or bad you are. Nonsense. So get rid of your scales. And we'll go into that more actually next week about the physical body. But relationships, a lot of people have been telling me that they're feeling stuck in relationships, and actually not in relationships, but out of relationships. So I've been talking to a lot of people who are divorced and, you know, kind of still in that process of, well, I was married and it was unhappy, and obviously because I was married to the wrong person, and so I got out of that relationship, and now I'm looking for not a bad person, I'm looking for a good person. Here we are back to good guys and bad guys, right? Oh, you know, with bodies, I forgot about that. Bodies, that's good guys and bad guys too. It's thin, fit people are the good guys, and fat, out of shape people are the bad guys in our society. Hey, that's not my opinion. I didn't make that up. Everybody knows. It's just go outside, look at a couple of billboards, and you can immediately see that. Good guys and bad guys. Are you a good guy or a bad guy, right? And your scale tells you. Your scale helps to tell you. Are you a good guy or a bad guy? Your marital status helps to tell you. Are you a good guy or a bad guy? Well, it depends. Are you the boss or are you the employee, right? And then again, that depends on the perspective, because the boss is the good guy if you happen to be the boss. So if I'm the boss and I think of myself as the good guy, right? If I'm the employee, I think of myself as the good guy and the boss would be the bad guy. That's why we have unions. Employees, right? The working man, the people that do all of the work because they have no choice, who work for the big bad managers and bosses, who are mean and grumpy and terrible just because they're bad guys. So a lot of people I know are feeling stuck in their career. And no lie, a lot of business owners that I know are feeling stuck in their career, and one of their number one complaints is employees. And it's really not that much of a surprise because the employee's number one complaint in most of these companies is their bosses. People, you know, people don't know how to honor one another. I mean, when we're living in fear and we don't realize the impact that we have on our own lives and we don't understand how life works and we actually do believe that we're victims, then the way we interact with everybody, that victimhood comes through. You know, we're always trying to protect ourselves. And a lot of times trying to protect ourselves comes across as attacking people. So, you know, somebody's got to be the bad guy. I mean, if I'm a victim of whom? I can't be a victim of myself, or can I? And that's, you know, that's the juicy stuff I really want to get to. We probably won't tonight, but yeah. So, you know, in the career place, if you take the victim mentality in there, we talked about it kind of ad nauseum with the employees and the employers, and it's all about perspective, isn't it? So if I'm an employee and I think of myself as having chosen to take a job and one that, you know, I feel good about working, then bottom line is I'm just glad to have the job and I don't care what day of the week or day of the year they ask me to work. If the company needs something and I've chosen to work for that company and they've extended the offer to me to work, they've accepted, and we have an agreement, they want me to work from midnight to 4 a.m. I'm there because that's the agreement. But I'm going to be compensated for that. But I have to know when I sign up for that sort of job that that's the deal. And, by the way, if I get down the road and I decide, oh, this isn't at all what I thought it was going to be, then because I know that I chose the job, I take responsibility for my employment situation, then that means that I can take responsibility for changing it. I'm never stuck. By never, you know, am I stuck for a couple of weeks or a couple of months maybe. but that's not stuck. That's just on hold. Money, okay. People who are feeling stuck with money, oh my gosh, everybody is feeling stuck with money these days. If you get out the newspaper or go online, you'll be really thrilled to find out that we haven't had any inflation. That's so exciting. It's like, yes, the recession that dragged on and on and on is sort of maybe over, which, you know, and, oh, good news, folks, we haven't had any inflation. So I came home the other night and asked my husband how it could be that we haven't had any inflation, and I had to spend $8.50 for a pound of coffee. How is that even remotely possible? No inflation, $8.50 for a pound of coffee. Yes, I mean, look at the prices of other things. I don't generally pay attention when I'm shopping because I buy the same. I'm a real habit shopper, so groceries, I buy the same stuff week in and week out, and you know when we're out, I buy more. But I started, because of the coffee incident, I started paying attention to the prices of groceries, and yeah, there's inflation out there. But if we try to talk about who are the good guys and who are the bad guys in terms of the inflation, once again, as soon as we decide that they're good guys and bad guys, we give up our power. We buy into the victim mentality. If we think that the tax, you know, that the tax authorities or agencies or whatever are the bad guys, then it's going to make us resent and avoid them. And if we look at them as being just other people who are doing jobs that they probably feel that they feel victims of, I mean, feel like there are jobs that they had to take, then we can understand that, you know, most of the people that you deal with in a tax authority are just people who are afraid of losing their job, just like everybody else. And they're following the orders of their government and elected officials. And, of course, the elected officials, in theory, represent what we want them to represent in the world. So, yeah, I even take responsibility. I mean, this is what I really learned throughout this whole thing, is that I also take responsibility for the state of money affairs in our world. In terms of, I participate. Right, so I'm responsible for choosing to participate, choosing how I participate, or choosing not to participate at all. But I'm not a victim. And this was the last one for me, actually. You know, for a long time, I felt like a victim of, I don't want to call it government conspiracy, but because, you know, that's always like in quotes. And George Orwell writes the book 1984, and everybody reads it, and, you know, even now after 1984, we all read it and go, yep, yep, I mean, that's it, isn't it, right there, that's it? And everybody agrees with that, but then somebody starts talking about how maybe people in power wanted to tax, you know, tax the working population, and people get all upset about it and start saying they're throwing around conspiracy theories. When have people in power ever not wanted to overtax the working people? That's what they do, because that's how they get power. I mean, that's what you do. But why? But why? Here's the good thing. Here's the really important thing. If I were to paint these people in government power, you know, whether they're tyrants or they're heads of democracies or communists or, you know, whatever it is, kings, right? Kings and queens and pharaohs, and it doesn't matter what sort of government body it is, but if the head of that government body, if I paint them as bad guys and I paint us as good guys, then immediately that puts me in the position of thinking that I am a victim. And if I believe that I am a victim, then what will I do? Then I will show up and I will do whatever I'm told to do. I'll be a really good follower. But if I realize that I am always participating in my own circumstances, and my own, in my body, my relationships, my career, and my financial circumstances always reflect what's going on in my mind, my attitude, my mental attitude about life. If I believe that I am a victim, it will show up. If I believe that my body is something beyond my control and it can't be trusted and there might be something wrong with it, you know, let's go back to the obesity thing and talk about the body for a moment. If I think that my body has urges, you know, cravings for food that I can't control, and my body's kind of something I can't trust or respect, then I'm going to put myself in a situation where I'm mentally engaged in a battle with my body. What does that look like? It means I wake up in the morning and I think, well, I wake up in the morning and I think, gee, I wonder how fat I am today. And I go and I hop on the scale and I look, oh dear, I'm bad, okay? My body's done it to me again. My body, not me, my body gained half a pound yesterday. This means I am less of a person than I was yesterday because my body has done this to me. And so now it's, oh, you know, I hate my body. My body's this, my body's that. I tell my body all kinds of horrible things about it. And I don't trust it because what happened is I'm thinking is yesterday, you know, I knew, like in my head, I knew I shouldn't eat that bag of chips. But I couldn't control myself. My body just went for the bag of chips. And so I ate them, and I had no control over it. And, you know, my body's got a really bad slow metabolism, and I mean, just on and on and on, the number of reasons why our bodies are out to get us. And what's happening is we're actually creating this inner battle. We're literally, in our minds, it's good guys and bad guys. You know, that whole good and evil thing and the knowledge, it wasn't good and evil. It was Adam and Eve eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It means believing, buying into good guys and bad guys, that there is good and evil in the world, and it's not all just a matter of perspective, that it's not fear or love. When we're in fear, we can only see in our what our waking consciousness is able to see, which is hardly anything. It is basically being blind. But the crumbs that are dropped in front of us happen to be enough that we can make out the bigger picture if we're focused upon doing that. But if we're scared and we're putting all of our energy into battling our bodies, battling our relationships with others, battling our career situations, our mean old bosses, our mean coworkers, those terrible clients, I mean, gosh, bad people abound. Or our financial situation, right? The bills are too high. The money's not enough. There's not enough savings. All of these things. If I put all of my effort into battling all of those things, I will be so busy battling this tip of the iceberg imaginary world or imaginary reality that I experience that I won't notice that what's right in front of me are the clues to the world that I really live in and how to master that. And that, of course, is by choosing love. It's by ceasing with the battles. It's by getting away from the whole notion of good guys and bad guys, letting it go, and realizing that the good guys are always us. Right? We're always referring to ourselves as the good guys. So if I have a particular, you know, if I'm female, which, well, I am. So with gender, it's really pretty binary, isn't it? Although there, you know, we've got some, there's a spectrum in there. There are even hermaphrodites on that spectrum. But generally speaking, if I'm male, then I think that, you know, the men are the good guys, the victims. Right. If I'm female, I think that the females are the good guys and the victims. Sometimes you can actually convince one group that the other group is the good guys. That's an interesting tactic, which we won't so much get into right now. But generally speaking, so you know what? I misspoke because I said the good guys are always the group we're in. It's not always the case, but usually. It's funny, I read something the other day that said, where it was about how the mind works. And it's this really fascinating thing that said, the mind always works in exactly this way, except for when it doesn't. And that's so true, because there are these variables. Let's just say that there are variables beyond our awareness that play into the way our minds work. And so while choosing fear or choosing love, and it's not usually choosing fear, right? It's just believing that you are the victim that you were taught to be because you grew up in this world that believes in good guys and bad guys. That is choosing fear. And what that does is it makes us stuck in lives that don't feel very good to us. Why? Because we're battling our bodies, we're battling our relationships, we're battling in our careers, and we're battling with our money. So what does that mean? It means everything feels like a freaking struggle and a challenge, and it never ends. And why would it end? Because you can't ever win that battle. Why? Because the battle's in your own head. It's always in our own heads. I see that we're kind of coming up to the end of the show here, and so I wanted to... one second. Yeah, so I wanted to just tell you a little bit, one story, or it's actually two little stories about relationship with the body. I was reading the book of Est, E-S-T, last week. Life-changing book, actually. And it was written by Luke Reinhardt back in the 1970s. And then Dr. Joe Vitale had it. I guess he got together with the publisher. It made such a big difference to him when he read it many years ago. He went to find out it was out of print, and he got involved in having it republished. And he wrote, I think it was an introduction or a foreword. It was an introduction. Anyway, the Book of Est is fabulous if you're even remotely interested in how the mind really operates. It was amazing. So one of the things that I learned in this great book was, you know, what we resist persists. And I knew that, right? We've all heard that. What we resist persists. Probably all heard it a million times. And I even kind of thought I knew what it meant. But what the Book of Est did was it took it a little bit further and said, don't try to change an experience. Which, again, you know, I use the fear blinds and love guides, so I choose love. So that's not trying to change the experience. It's trying to see through love's eyes that I am always in a position of personal power, that I am always responsible for my experience, that I am always choosing it, whether consciously or not, right? But in the Book of Est, it said, don't try to change the experience. Go into it deeply, and it will disappear. You will get a new one. And I thought, yeah, interesting, of course, because if life is presenting messages, if the struggles and the challenges and the adversaries that we meet in our life are life's way of trying to show us that we're basically doing battle instead of learning, and that we're thinking that we're in some sort of battleground environment instead of in a big classroom, where we are, you know, safe and loved and perfect exactly as we are, then you can see that as soon as you get the message, then the symptom or the challenge would go away, right? So it's almost like, what was I telling somebody about? Panic attacks. Well, it's a whole book, but it was about the panic attack. And so my panic attacks start, and they come, and they bother me, and I'm running to hospital emergency rooms, and it's an awful, awful thing. And all of a sudden, I start looking into, I'm trying to make them stop. All I care about is make it stop, make it stop, make it stop. Something's wrong. And then I actually step back and say, wait a minute, maybe I better get to know what these anxiety attacks were all about. You know, I lived a lot of years without them. Maybe I can find out what started them and how to get rid of them. And so I did, and I wrote a whole book about it, right? But in the process of doing that, when I learned about the attacks, when I started paying attention to them and learned what had caused them, they went away. And so I thought of it as like my panic attacks, which had once seemed like they had been my body's attacks on me, suddenly were transformed in my mind into these messengers who came and they were serving me. You know, the attacks came up and they said, knock, knock, we have a message for you. Knock, knock, we have a very important message for you. Knock, knock, very important message. And I kept saying, go away, don't want to hear it. Nope. Very, very busy over here trying to manage my weight, my relationships, my career, and my money. No time for you. Please go away. You're making my life even harder than it already is. The panic attacks persisted. Knock, 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 knock. Finally, right? Finally, and I do mean years, finally, like years later, I go over and I'm like, what? I open the door. Knock, knock, what? What do you want? Well, we just thought you'd like to know that you've created a really toxic environment inside your head. You think you're living in a battleground, and look what it's doing to you. If you were to step back from that experience and stop trying to control everything in your life, you might realize that everything in your life is actually trying to tell you something quite beautiful. I was like, whoa, really? And then the panic attack said, yes, really. And they bowed once I'd heard the message, and they went away. Why? Because I didn't need them anymore. And so go into whatever it is that we're resisting, go into it deeply. Whatever we are struggling with, go into it deeply, and it will disappear. You'll get a new one. Why? Because you don't need that particular one anymore. You don't need that lesson anymore. This actually works with physical pain. I have a tooth that I cracked back in the day. I ground my teeth like crazy all the time. And so I cracked my tooth, and I was told that I should have it pulled out. And I said, you know, I'm going to give this guy a chance to deliver his message and be on his way. So I guess it's been about 3 years now. And a couple of times the pain has gotten not good. And I really was toying around with the idea of having my tooth pulled, you know, finally like, okay, well, maybe it's just time to let it go. Maybe this tooth doesn't follow the normal pattern of having a message to deliver, and then it can go back to its normal state of health. And so, you know, maybe I'm just wrong. Not I'm wrong, but maybe it's not always, right? Maybe it's one of those situations where the mind always works this way except for sometimes. Maybe it's a sometimes situation. And I thought I could deal with that. But then in the Book of Est, I was learning about going deeply into your experience. And so when my tooth started to hurt, I imagined like mentally traveling into my tooth and into the pain. And I started feeling for it. And I was imagining what color the pain would be, and what size it would be, and what substance, like was it rock or was it, you know, cotton or whatever. And I kept going round and round and round. And before long, and by when I say before long, I mean within like 90 seconds, the pain disappeared. It was gone. And then I felt a tweak in my toe, you know, like completely unrelated. So my mind automatically shot down to my toe, and I tried to feel the pain, like I tried to see it and feel it and experience it, and every time I did, it just went away. And what I read in the book is that this is common, and it doesn't just work with our physical pains. It works with other situations, which we are going to talk about primarily next week. I'm sorry you guys didn't get a chance to call in. I miss having my audience participation. On the flip side, you know, I don't believe in luck or misfortune. I believe everything happens exactly the way it's meant to. And so for this day and our time together and for life itself, just let me say thank you. And I hope you have a wonderful evening. Thanks. See you next week. Bye-bye.